We are whistle ready at the Quick Restart Podcast. Like that? Whistle ready.
Thank you for coming back to the Quick Restart Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined as always and once again by Quint Kasnick. Quint, it is officially championship week, and we are going to straddle the line between looking ahead and looking back. And we've had a number of weeks over the course of this season where there's been lacrosse pretty much every day, but never more meaningfully than this week ahead. So we are going to go day by day, and we're going to start with Tuesday, but first we're actually going to start with Sunday. And so when we look ahead to next Sunday, Selection Sunday, 7 days away, we have one game, which is the Patriot League Championship. And then as we rewind to the Sunday that was, we are recording in the midst of Binghamton's postponed makeup game, I guess is what I would say, against UMass Lowell, which happened in the wake of a house fire that affected the lacrosse equipment of more than a dozen players on the team. And unfortunately, this game could have had very meaningful stakes with the Bearcats competing for the America East, a spot in the America East tournament, but based on Vermont's wins, that opportunity fell by the wayside. But of course, that was only one of two games on Sunday. The other, a de facto ACC championship that you were on hand for in Keenan Stadium in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, with Anish Shroff and Paul Carcaterra. And you guys called Coach Joe Bresci's team's 15-12 win over the Duke Blue Devils. What was it like being in a stadium with more than 4,000 fans calling a game?
Oh, it was cool. It was great. I do want to start with a fun fact about this podcast. You always email me a rundown. I never read it till after the show, so I kind of fly blind. Today, though, it was really cool to get to the stadium. We had to travel solo. You know, we're still obviously – we're there in person, but we're socially distanced with masks on when we're inside. When we're spread out and on the air, our mask could be off. But, you know, to see the players, I was right there at the trucks when the Duke team parked their bus and walked on by. So we got to see all of them, got to talk to Matt Danowski, got to talk to Ned Crotty, got to talk to Coach Danowski in person. It's the first time, you know, I've talked to coaches in person in, I don't know, 432 days since Kark and Anish and I called a game together in person. But so that was fascinating to see the guys. You know, sometimes I think I forget how big, strong, and athletic everybody is nowadays because, you know, getting off the bus, like this guy walks by me, I'm like, oh, nice looking player. And I look, oh, that's Michael Sowers. Oh, he's not that small. He's my size. And then you see some of the monsters. So the kids are just better looking than they've ever been. But to be at a live game, to be able to see the whole field and call it was interesting. It was kind of different after getting used to a whole season being at home and all, calling it off the TV monitor. But the crowd was awesome. The game was really good. It was an interesting game emotionally because both teams are still alive. They're going to be a 1, 2, or 3 seed regardless. They're playing for an ACC championship. And while that's kind of bragging rights around campus and in the athletic department, in the lacrosse world, I don't think we attach much significance to an ACC championship, honestly. So it was a good day for Carolina. They fixed a lot of things that were that caused them to lose the regular season, that, you know, the earlier game over at Koskinen. And I think it brings up some red flags for Duke going forward.
What are those red flags?
Midfielders who can't beat their man and get to the goal. Clearing and riding, kind of not being up to par with a UNC, a Virginia, or a Notre Dame. And then defensive issues, getting beat, struggling with picks behind the goal, getting beat by speed dodgers, and their second slide is either not there or there without a third or a rotation behind it. They face some face-off inconsistencies in that game. I think the numbers ended up being relatively even, but the second quarter when you lose, I don't know,
they lost seven of eight.
9 face-offs in a row. They got outshot 22-7 in that quarter, and the game was over. The game, you know, 7-0 quarter with teams of this quality, game is over. So it went from 4-2 Duke to 11-4 North Carolina. It was a 9-goal run over 20 minutes. Game over.
No question that was the period, the stretch that decided it. One note on your point about midfield dodging, midfield scoring that stood out to me. Garrett Ledman was a player that we've talked about in 2019, 2020 on this podcast, but really hadn't been super present. At one point, he had 5 shots and had yet to score. He scored on his 6th. He finished shooting 1-for-7 as a second-line midfielder. The reliance on him in this game was something that stood out to me. And I just want to make the point on the opposite side, which is you in the Open talked about North Carolina's depth of scoring with the number of players with 10 goals and more than 20 points. And nine players scored a goal in this game. And I think that's meaningful because Tanner Cook, who is probably their most reliable scoring threat from the midfield, didn't play due to injury. Cole Herbert, the freshman, highly recruited, highly regarded out of Calvert Hall, stepped into his spot to keep the second line intact, and he scored what I think was kind of the dagger, the 15th goal of the game, that represented what I think was the second thing to be excited about or proud of if you're a Carolina fan. The first was obviously that torrent that you went on in the second quarter and opening the second half. But then the other side of the coin was Duke cut it to 13-8, which was the score that they trailed Notre Dame by before coming back to win that game. And North Carolina answered every time Duke scored a goal until less than 3 minutes, and then the game was pretty much out of reach. And I think that was another aspect of the kind of mental toughness that you want to see out of this Carolina squad if you think they have an actual chance of winning the national championship.
You know, it just felt like Carolina needed this game more than Duke did. You know, and Duke, if you look back historically, has typically not played their best in the ACC tournament. It was almost like there were years that they felt that, you know, playing one game and going home and prepping for the NCAA tournament may have been more important. So I don't know where they were at in terms of motivation. You know, they had won all those close calls, the three overtime games, the four games in the league by two or less goals. Certainly they're going to be a top caliber team. I think Duke gets a two or three seed. Carolina, you mentioned the goal scoring runs, you know, it's Perry, Gray, Anderson, Tillman, Gray, Cameron, Anderson. So then McCarthy scores and then Scherzinger scores. And I think there's tremendous value in depth of scoring. It's something that Leif Elsmoe taught me back in the mid-90s. You know, he always said, you know, if a team's too reliant on one or two guys, somewhere along the line, someone's going to develop a scheme to shut them down. And the further you advance in the tournament, the better the defenses are. And so to have answers, to have options, to have second tier guys in that second midfield who can get you a goal and an assist, I think is a huge plus, especially now, Terry, in the shot clock era, where back then your second midfield could go out and just muck it up for a minute. And guys would actually throw it around for a minute, throw it to the attack, and then they'd sub off for the first midfield who was able to catch their breath. Now you can't do that. So if the second midfield can actually get something going in their 82nd possession, I think that's huge.
I think North Carolina is the number one seed in the NCAA tournament. Do you agree?
It's Carolina or Maryland. You know, I know there seems to be a lot of emphasis lately on strength of record. I look at
strength record's not an NCAA criteria.
I know, but people keep
that's fine. It's not an NCAA criteria
in a year that we don't have criteria. There's no such thing as NCAA criteria right now. They haven't clearly stated what it is.
I agree with that.
So we're just all guessing right now. I've talked to members on the committee. The RAC is talking to the committee every week. There is no criteria established for the season.
With that, let us typewriter to Tuesday, where this Tuesday coming up, we will have the Patriot League quarterfinals, which in and of themselves kind of smack of no criteria, given that they were non-existent about 2.5 weeks ago. Nonetheless,
exactly.
The Boston University Terriers take on the Colgate Raiders. They're still the Raiders, right?
They were the Red Raiders. I'm sure they got rid of that. I used to call him Mr. Pasty. You know, my brother was the head coach of Colgate, and he wanted to bring the Mr. Pasty, which is like a cartoon character of a little
toothpaste
container with a lacrosse stick.
The Loyola Greyhounds host the Navy Midshipmen at 5 p.m. on ESPN+. Those games are on Tuesday. Let's talk about the Greyhounds' 11-9 win over Georgetown on Thursday. I was in attendance. The game was on CBS Sports. And for me, I start by saying it was a game plan win in the sense that defensively, Jake Haraway got 4-1. I didn't think Cam Wires had his best game. Graham Bundy looked very good. Dylan Hess is a terror of like the type of player who will make you wake up in the middle of the night before you play them when you think about having to game plan for them over the course of the next 3 years. But generally speaking, thought Dylan Watson was contained. TJ Haley had 4 assists in the first half. The Hoyle offense went cold in the third quarter. Kevin Warren's first comment post game was, "It's the worst game we've played all year." Loyola, for their money, I mean, they won the game because they limited Georgetown to 9 goals. But it's a really weird thing for a team who put up 12 on Virginia and put up 40 in 2 games in the middle of this season. They scored 40 goals in a 2-game stretch. I was really impressed at their ability to get to 11, particularly because Aiden Olmstead, I mean, he had the biggest goal of the game, the last goal of the game to kind of separate things, but he really didn't have a strong impact prior to that. Kevin Lindley, in my opinion, really put the team on his back, scored the most important goals in the midst of the game that ended up winning it. Peter Swindell, the midfielder who's been drawing the pole most consistently, had his best game of the season with 2-2. Bailey Savio struggled early, settled in, did a nice job. And Sam Schaefer, the goalie, who hasn't been the goalie all season, they've fluctuated with their starter, played really well as well. So for me, I just give credit to the game plan. I thought that, you know, whether it was catching Georgetown on an off day, a very, very, very damaging off day, or coming into the game with a good plan, the pieces just fell into place for Loyola.
They had a plan, but I was impressed with Loyola's mental toughness, because there were times in this game where the game could have gone south, and they just kept fighting. And, you know, watching the game, you're saying, gosh, it's hard for Loyola to score. You know, nothing comes easy for them. But they were able to find ways. You know, they scored a key extra man goal. They scored a key transition goal. Swindell hit an outside shot. So I was impressed. It was hard. I'm watching this game saying, wow, this team's lost more games than they should have based on what I'm seeing tonight. So maybe they've turned the corner. When it comes down to Georgetown, you know, sloppy turnovers, defensive miscues, which are really not like them. When you see the unassisted goals that the other opponent's scoring, that's very, you know, guys beating their man and there being no help. Penalties in the third quarter, boneheaded penalties. I mean, that's just bad technique, taking guys' heads off with cross checks.
Yep.
And then shot selection. Schaefer gets a lot of credit. Go back and watch Carraway's shots. I mean, he took 15 of them. Watch some of the other shots. There's just a lot of high to the stick that the keeper was catching. So shot selection, penalties, defensive miscues, and turnovers. And this game, in my mind, though, spun the whole narrative just crazy. That, like, wow, the Patriot League number 4 team is better than the Big East number 2 team. Well, a day or two later, that gets flipped on its head.
The Big East number 3 team
to Nova.
The Big East number 3 team doubles up the Patriot League number 1 team.
I thought I knew exactly how to operate, and now, like, all the data points are crisscrossing.
100%. Do you want to talk about that game now? I don't have a ton to say about it.
I mean, Nova, I thought, could have beaten Denver midweek. It was a kind of a tough loss, especially the game-winning goal. It left a bad taste in my mouth. Yes, it was just not a great slide up field to a lefty driving right-handed. Kotler, who, like, bounce passes it to Walker, who dives across the tangent and scores. And, you know, you think that game knocks the wind out of you from a team standpoint. But I give Villanova a lot of credit, because they came back and took down Lehigh. And they only won 5 faceoffs.
They just looked more physically dominant. I had it on my iPad while I was watching Notre Dame Syracuse on the TV, and every time I looked at, I mean, just there are a lot of. It's so weird because Villanova's reputation, I think, this stems from John Clue, who, in my mind, hasn't played in a Villanova game for like 7 years. That they're all a bunch of Smurfs, but there are a couple of dodging midfielders who are hulking, and the defenders, Probilski, Kennedy, Kryza, I mean, Probilski and Kennedy especially, are big, and they just took the ball away. I mean, it was just Lunch Money City all over the field, and that is what made up for that faceoff deficiency. I just felt like those two teams went toe-to-toe, and Villanova won the physical battle, which is not what this program's reputation had been.
Yeah, and maybe Lehigh in the Patriot League was able to win with faceoffs, goaltending, and a smart little offense that zings the ball around, and that didn't work against Villanova, who made it more of a me against you ball game, and I'm bigger, faster, stronger. I don't know. But again, this was eye opening because it's the 4th best team in the Big East, taking down the number 1 team out of the Patriot League.
The 3rd best team in the Big East.
Well, the 3rd seed now, but they were 4th. Like 2 weeks ago.
Okay. Let's move on to Wednesday. It's a great day. I talked a couple weeks ago of how good of a day Friday, April 30th was going to be, and I feel vindicated. We had two MAC quarterfinals that were decided in the last 5 seconds of the game. And on Wednesday, we've got the NEC, MAC, and SoCon semifinals. We've got games that start at 1 p.m., 2 p.m., 3 p.m., 5:30, 7 p.m., and 8 p.m. So you could literally just be on your computer or iPad watching lacrosse from 1 p.m. until 10 p.m. And what's cool about it is not only do these games promise to be really exciting, but also you're going to get to see a lot of teams that you probably haven't watched a ton of so far this year. So we got St. Joe's versus LIU, Hobart versus Bryant. That's the 1-4-2-3 matchups in the NEC. Those are the two early games. We've got Mama St. Bonaventure, the Bonnies, who won their first game in program history earlier this year, upset a team in the quarterfinals in order to advance their first MAC victory of all time. And then Canisius taking on the number one seed Manhattan, which Canisius, having survived a scare against Marist, who I think pretty much everybody expected to be the best team in the MAC heading into this season. Monmouth, the two seed, survived a one-goal game against Siena, who ended their year winless. And we got Manhattan, who had a bye week because of COVID protocols, keeping a couple teams, or at least one team, out of the MAC tournament. That is going to be very exciting. And then in the SoCon semifinals, we've got Richmond versus Air Force, High Point versus Jacksonville, both rematches of games that took place on Saturday, including Air Force beating Richmond 9-8, Richmond's first loss in the SoCon, a game that got the Falcons into the tournament. If it hadn't gone that way and the Bellarmine-Mercer result had been what it was, Bellarmine would have gotten that 4 seed, and then High Point beating Jacksonville 16-11. So if you're into lacrosse, I highly recommend setting aside some time on Wednesday afternoon to soak this all up.
Yeah, I wish we could broadcast more of these games. Now, the good news is they're on, you know, CBS, they're on Big Ten, they're on all sorts of other networks, LSN, which is fantastic to see. They're spread out enough that you can watch, you know, multiple games each day. That's cool, too.
It has a March Madness type vibe to it. The endings will not conflict with each other.
Terry, the coolest thing here, though, is we got, I counted, what, 36? How many leagues have 6? Just the Patriot?
So, yeah, I was confused by that number because it was 30.
Eight times four is 32.
Well,
35.
Plus, it was 35 plus to start, two. But 5 teams have already been eliminated. 3 MAC teams and 2 Big Ten teams have been eliminated already. It should have been 36,
so four,
but we had one.
I got 4 times 8 plus 2 is 34. I thought one other league still had 6 left.
There are 30 teams that are still in contention right now. There were 35 Friday morning.
What leagues less than 4?
None. There are only 7 leagues, but the Patriot League has 6. There are 7 AQs
There's 8 AQs. 8 times 4 is 32.
You got me on my heels here.
8 times 4 is 32. 32 plus 32 is 64.
So then it's
got to
be
34 is 128. Inchworm. Measuring the marigolds. You and your arithmetic, you'll probably go far. You never heard that song, Terry. That's why you can't add. 8 times 4 is 32. There's 32 plus 2 teams still in contention. It's at least 34.
Go ahead. Keep it rolling. You're on a roll.
It's 32 plus 6. It's 32 plus 2.
Because the Patriot League is the only conference that still has 6 teams
left. They have 6. Yeah, 7 times 4 is 28 plus 6 is 34.
I believe you.
Yeah, and you should, because that's a number.
Well, but you have a second part of your sentence that you haven't said yet.
What is that?
That it's very cool that this is the extension of the NCAA tournament. That people complain about bracket expansion, but this is bracket expansion.
No, and yeah, again, this is bracket expansion. You might have to edit this podcast because we just went off the rails there. But
we are coming off of our most popular podcast of the year when you told me to edit this section out, and I think it was the part that people liked the most. Okay. So I think
the
this natural
song,
dynamic.
Not only is this an extension of the NCAA tournament, which is great. I love it. Okay, invest in it. Like, seize these games. Put these games up on – like these moments when these teams win these championships. This is great stuff. I mean, this is – again, this is why teams like Marquette, Richmond – Mercer, this is why these programs, A, start a team, and B, why they invest for this week to get in the NCAA tournament. This is what it's all about. We'll welcome everybody. I mean, everybody's got a league, except just a handful.
Well, not anymore.
Like, this is your shot.
Not anymore.
This is your shot.
With Utah, Cleveland State, Robert Moore. Well, Robert Moore still has another game, but with Utah and Cleveland State season being over, they're officially members of the A-Sun, as far as I'm concerned. So we await the addition of not only the return of the Ivy League AQ, but also the addition of the A-Sun AQ, which will get us back to 10 AQs, get us back to two playing games in 2022. It's going to be fantastic. And I promise that when we do this podcast 365 days from now, we won't have this level of arithmetic disagreement or errors on my end in terms of how many teams are still competing for
inchworm. You keep talking inchworm, measuring the marigolds.
Did you guys have PEMDAS? You and please excuse my dear Aunt Sally.
Excuse me, what?
PEMDAS, please excuse my dear Aunt Sally.
Oh no, what is that?
It's the order of operations. So parentheses,
it's very Ohio-ish.
Exponents, and then MDAS.
How come you're not a huge Scherzinger fan? He's from Cincinnati.
There are enough Ohio guys. We'll get to Mike Bain. We'll get to Connor Camille later in the podcast.
Okay. Well, I mean, you got a guy on North Carolina. You don't seem to be what you got something against the Scherzingers or something?
Cincinnati's 4 hours you're away
more
from
of a
me.
Are you more of a Cleveland guy than a Cincy guy?
Absolutely. I mean, Kentucky can have Cincinnati is my attitude toward that. Let's move to Thursday. America East semifinals, UMBC versus Albany, 1 p.m., Vermont versus Stony Brook at 4 p.m. You are an America East superfan now.
I know. I got a question. Can I go to these games? It's right down the street. I could actually probably ride my bike to Catonsville. My sister works in Catonsville. I would love to go to these games because I can. I'll be home this week. Got the selection show on Sunday. But otherwise, I'm just like looking for games to go to and watch. Is this game going to be open to the public?
I mean, you're not the public. I'm sure that you could figure out a way to get in. If not, well, I actually know a way to sneak onto the complex that I can help you out with.
Oh, I could easily go for a jog around and sit up at the top of the hill and watch the games.
I don't know whether or not they're allowing fans. Probably. I know that Baltimore County, Towson is.
We could pretend we're having an ultimate Frisbee game between the two of us on that hill and throw the Frisbee back and forth while we watch the lacrosse game. I mean, that's how easy it would be, Terry. I can wear a UMBC Retriever basketball t-shirt. You know, we beat Virginia, and you can wear like a headband, a black and gold headband. Go Retrievers, and we'll just pretend we're students on the chess team and throw a Frisbee back and forth while the games go on down below in the field.
You're not going to try to head out to the old stomping grounds, the Hempstead Turnpike, for the CAA semifinals at Hofstra. Number one seed Delaware taking on the host Pride at 4 p.m. The number two seed Drexel Dragons taking on the number three seed UMass Minutemen at 7 p.m. Both those games on LAC Sports Network. The crazy part about this is that a committee picked the teams in seeding. The potential tiebreakers in terms of criteria were not implemented because of, as far as I understand it, the CAA's early decision to essentially not mandate the way in which their members scheduled this season, such that the tiebreakers were potentially going to hold up mathematically. And so they put in this committee, I guess, kind of loophole in order to build out the tournament fields.
That's crazy. I mean, that is the ultimate let's make it up as we go along.
Fortunately, they did it like a long time ago, and now they've got
in this conference. I don't trust very much. I mean, I know Drexel and Delaware are ahead of the pack, but nothing would shock me in this league. Nothing would shock me in the America East either, honestly. What would shock you? If Hofstra won this, would you be shocked? I'd be surprised.
No, I wouldn't be shocked.
There's no result in the America East that would shock me.
Yeah, the only thing that would shock me about the America East is if anybody put up a big goal total on UMBC. Like, if anybody scored more than 13 goals on UMBC, I'd be surprised. Other than that, none of the available outcomes to the three games that are going to happen would surprise me. I mean, the fact that Vermont is the two seed surprises me. So, like, I'm already surprised just on the basis of how the season unfolded. Not because, like, I didn't think they were good enough to be the two seed, but because in the games that I've seen of theirs, like, they've lost a disproportionate number of them comparatively to be allowed to be the two seed. So just in terms of the way the America East seeding math worked out, I am surprised. But as far as
that finals, that finals a TV game. I think 10 a.m.
It is. It always is. It's typically brunch with Mark Dixon. And the fact that it's in Catonsville makes it even probably saltier that I'm sure he's going to have to go to State College in order to call that game. The CAA semifinals, I mean, the only thing about that is the game that formed my impression of these four teams more than any other was the first Delaware-Drexel game, which was a Delaware blowout. Like, they totally handled them. And as a result, like, I just really struggled to get over that. And as Drexel has put together this amazing season since then, I've just routinely been surprised, impressed. I mean, I think I said it 2 or 3 weeks ago, like, Drexel is the most surprising team of the year to me. Like, they are probably not going to get an at-large bid, but they deserve to be in the conversation. And that is a country mile from where I would have thought they were going to be when we had this conversation on January 30th.
Russ Blumenthal is a former camper, friend school goalie. Goes way back to my camp, back when he was a little fourth grader. Got to root for the Dragons, House of the Dragon.
No doubt. The Big Ten semifinals at Penn State, number 1 Maryland taking on number 5 Michigan at 5 p.m. on the Big Ten Network. Number 2 Rutgers taking on number 6 Johns Hopkins at 7:30. Following that, you called it on Hopkins. I am disappointed in myself for not sticking with my Wolverine call, which I called them in their first game against Maryland, and I think probably 3 or 4 other times over the course of the year. I think I got one of them right, but on Friday, when I was looking at my picks, I actually wrote about how I felt like Michigan was coming off of the two best performances in program history. Their losses to Penn State and Rutgers, I thought, were the best I had ever seen a Michigan team look. And I didn't have the courage to call.
Again, that's right.
Michigan Terry, over you know why? Ohio State.
Because if you look at it on the surface, they lost. Well, they should have beaten Penn State. And they actually played quite well against Rutgers until the last 5 minutes or so.
Yeah.
So that's exactly right. If you're watching them play, you've seen them improve. If you're watching Johns Hopkins, you knew that, wow, this is a little much better against Maryland. And this is a great matchup with them going against Penn State, whose defense is head-shakingly bad. And so the Hopkins win didn't surprise me. I actually like the Jays against Rutgers. I don't know what the line's going to be. I'd take them every day of the week in this matchup. If they win faceoffs, I think they'll score. The question is, Kirst he was so hot in the goal last time. They had their opportunities, and they got to figure out a way to stop the Rutgers attack. But there's no pressure on the Blue Jays. This Rutgers team probably has to win this game to be considered at large, especially if there's some bid thievery. So I don't know. The Blue Jays are on fire. They won one in a row. I mean, I just think they'll keep it rolling.
I talked to Pete Milliman when he was in the car on the way back from State College and said he texted Kevin Connery saying, congratulations, big win. And Connery replied, every win is a big win this year. And I think that's true. I mean, you know, I do not want to talk about the relative strength of conferences, especially the Big Ten, to anybody else, because just in terms of intellectual honesty, I default to the position that we cannot know how good the Big Ten is compared to everybody else.
No,
I understand how good they look, and the answer is not very good compared to what we have seen other teams do. But we can't know. They haven't played anybody else. So the point is, Michigan beat Ohio State because they did such a good job riding. And they got some garbage goals, and they got confidence, and they dropped into a zone that gave Ohio State a little bit of fits. They settled for bad shots, particularly early, and that was when they developed their confidence. And, I mean, honestly, like, I don't have a whole lot more to say than that. Like, Jacob Jackson, Jake Bonomi, like, these guys are young, they're good.
Love Bonomi, love that kid.
He's awesome. Like, he's taking wings and faceoffs as well
hair,
as...
plays with his hair on fire, that kid.
You
watch his Hopkins game, I think he's had a hat trick. He was unbelievable.
They got a
lot
hands.
Of young players in that team who are really good.
Yep.
They're attackmen from Grand Rapids.
Bryce Clay,
what a monster he is. Dodger, I mean, Ryder.
The only thing that makes me a little... And I guess, you know, he's actually a sophomore, but he's a junior technically. If he were a year younger, if he has 3 years left after this year, like, when you look at the 21s and 22s that are coming in, if they progress at the level of the 20s and the 19s, Michigan is going to be a bona fide top 20 team in 2 years. Like a at-large contender, no question about it, type team. Bryce Clay, to me, is the emotional center of that squad. I know this comparison is going to draw scoffs, but there is a lot about his mindset and off-field style and persona that reminds me of Matt Rambo, down to the affinity for working landscaping in the summertime.
He doesn't remind you of Ben Reeves. No, he and his brother own a landscaping company up in Grand Rapids.
And Matt Rambo worked landscaping every summer when he was at Maryland. I have a lot of respect for landscapers. This is what I did during college.
It's what I do every freaking day of the week.
No, you garden. You do not landscape. Landscaping is a yard. Filling a wheelbarrow with 400 pounds of
fast.
Dirt
My grass is
and
on
gravel.
Steroids. I can't.
Digging sod out of a hole in the ground so that you can fill it with gravel so you can build a patio. And this is what we did. We would put a ramp up into a dump truck, and we would run the wheelbarrow full of 400 pounds of sod up to the dump truck into the bed.
That's awesome. What a great workout.
It was unbelievable. I can't believe I didn't do it in high school because I would have been in great shape. But did it with he was a couple years younger than me, but a high school football teammate who ended up going on to play Miami of Ohio, playing offensive line at Miami of Ohio, and tore his labrum working landscaping.
Cradle of the coaches.
Not a great outcome.
Great spot, Oxford. Love that place. Last thing about the Big Ten tournament, it's on BTN. Dixie and Joe Beninati have the semis on Thursday. Joe can't make the finals. He's got the final. He's got something else going on with hockey, so I'm not sure who they're bringing in. Probably Pete Medhurst will cover the final. But, you know, the week off for Rutgers and Maryland, it wouldn't surprise me if they got slow starts. I think the worst thing that Michigan ever did, though, against Maryland was getting out to that 5-0 lead because they will have the attention of John Tillman and the Terps. I guarantee it.
Totally right.
The opposite is true, where Rutgers is going to try to beat Hopkins for a third time. The second time they played, it was a lot closer than it looked. A couple little swing plays in that game. So I expect the Rutgers-Hopkins game to be an outstanding, close, well-contested, probably high-scoring game.
Big East semifinals bringing down the curtain on Thursday. We've got number one Denver versus number four Providence at 5:30 on CBS Sports Network. The games are in Providence. Following that, number two Georgetown versus number three Villanova. That game appropriately scheduled for 8:30. It's interesting CBS Sports games are always so much longer than ESPNU games. Well, you guys try to get them into 2 hours. They try to stretch them into 2.5 hours.
Yeah, we're trying to get ours done in two. They're trying to stretch theirs to 2:30 until the playoffs. But I will say this, an 8:30 start time,
that's
and I
late.
Wrote about it in my column, 8:30 start time's late for the winter. It really is, because after the game, it's 10:45, 11 o'clock. You got to rehydrate. You got to get dressed. You got to shower. You got to go back to the hotel. You got to get your food. Next thing you know, it's 1 o'clock and you can't sleep. Like, that's a disadvantage. I hate to say it in a short-term format. I would like to see that bumped up to 8 o'clock start at the latest, and preferably more like 7:30.
Friday, Southern Conference Championship, Patriot League semifinals. Also, Syracuse versus Robert Morris, the Orange coming off of a 22-8 beatdown in South Bend at the hands of the Irish. I wrote about this game, and I texted a couple of players, parents, coaches with Notre Dame afterwards, and I was just like, tell me what you think mattered about this game, because it was so thorough. I have a really hard time picking any one thing, and I settled on Pat Kavanaugh as a top three Wharton contender because he put up a program record tied 10 points, 5 goals and 5 assists, very balanced, picked up 5 ground balls. He, yes, committed a turnover, but he caused 2 turnovers. Pat Kavanaugh was awesome. Awesome.
Yeah, he's a good player.
Meanwhile, Syracuse
really
has to take on Robert Morris.
Yeah, Cuse needs a Robert Morris game to kind of figure out what they're going to do on defense with all those injuries. And now, you know, they got all sorts of defensive injuries. Nobody can cover anybody from the midfield position, so they got to go zone. They fall behind. They've got this off-field adversity stuff that's hitting them. So that wasn't good. I thought they played okay for 20 minutes, and then that game got out of hand. I mean, I turned it on in the third quarter. It was gross. Couldn't believe Notre Dame didn't sub till they did, but that's fine too because they got it rolling. Everybody got involved in the action. Kavanaugh was devastating. It's a really good Notre Dame team. I mean, top to bottom, you could say they're the most balanced and best team in the country, really. They had a little tough scheduling snafu. They had Duke by 5 goals, lost that game. 3 days later, they got to play at Carolina. I think they're right there with the teams who can win the national championship. Unbelievable face-off game. Good young goalie. He needs to clean things up in May. Great attack, star player, defensive system. But they check all the boxes. Notre Dame checks all the boxes.
With respect to Cuse and their injuries, post-game John Desko said that they hoped they were going to have Brandon Aviles in their game versus Notre Dame, so they expect to have Aviles as well as Dami Oladomoye returning for their Robert Morris game, and then presumably beyond that. Still no word on Nick DiPietro, and to my knowledge, Jacob Buttermore is done for the season.
Yeah, just not good defensively at a team that's again, faceoffs now are really inconsistent. One week they're good, one week they're bad. For the most part, it hasn't been a strong area. So I think Cuse gets in. Clearly, they have an at-large resume. Using old school methodology, they would actually get a seed, but I'm not sure that's going to happen this year.
Yeah, it's interesting because margin of victory doesn't matter. It's not a criteria, but if the eye test matters more, it suggests pretty clearly that margin of victory will matter. And they've gotten blown out four times.
Yeah.
On Saturday, we've got 6 championship games. You mentioned the America East starts at 10 a.m. at UMBC, CA at 1 p.m., Big East at 3, Big Ten at 8. The MAC and NEC championships, both of which will be held at higher seeds. Those game times are TBD. I'm hoping that one starts at noon and one starts at 5. That would just round out the day perfectly. But we shall see how the schedule comes together. Quint, I mean, I don't want to make you get emotional again, but I just want to say that
will never happen again.
This is the best time of the year. I mean, it is
fun. Again, I think John Anowski this week talked about, you know, celebrating the opportunity, and, you know, to complete a regular season where teams played 10 or more games in a lot of cases, that's pretty cool. Because if you asked me in January, I said that probably not going to happen, that we're still on schedule. Like, we didn't get pushed back. We didn't get canceled. We didn't get shut down. That, you know, games have been played. We had some non-conference play, which was pretty cool. You know, championship week is really like the same as it's ever been. So we're in a pretty good spot. So let's celebrate this last week. I know these athletes have been through a ton in the last year, and all that discipline, all that sacrifice, all that common sense, all those things add up into this opportunity. This is what you did it for this week.
We are going to savor the flavor on InsideLacrosse.com, so make sure to join us. I'm actually going to try to do a couple things that haven't done previously. Twitter Spaces is something that I joined one on Saturday morning before the games got going. I really enjoyed that. So if you've got any, I don't know, hankering for some user interaction, hit us up. I'm at Terrence Foy. He's at Q Kesnick. We are at Inside_Lacrosse. If you like what you heard, leave a rating and review. We will be back later in the week with more Inside Lacrosse podcasts. And Quint, next week, we are going to be talking about the NCAA tournament bracket.
Yes, Selection Sunday, May 9th, 9 o'clock, ESPNU right now. Excited for that opportunity. Bracket reveal, analysis, we'll set up the tournament.
We are whistle ready at the Quick Restart Podcast. Like that? Whistle ready.